Ahoy, authors! You're listening to the Writership Podcast, a show focused on helping indie authors master self-editing skills. So come aboard and get ready to find the treasure in your manuscript with hosts Leslie Watts and Clark Chamberlain.
Welcome to episode 109 of the Writership Podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about where to begin your story. I'm Leslie Watts, here with Clark Chamberlain from the Book Editor Show. To learn more about the podcast, visit writership.com/podcast.
As you know, the Writership Podcast is brought to you by Jim Kukral and Author Marketing Club. Jim has just launched a new business for nonfiction authors called Business Around a Book. So if you're a nonfiction author, visit www.businessaroundabook.com and let Jim help you turn your nonfiction book into a profitable, life-changing business. That's businessaroundabook.com.
Hey, Clark.
Hey, long time no chat.
I know. Oops, I was taking care
jumping
of
away from your microphone.
Yeah, for a moment there. I'm back. It's so great to have you back. I've missed you.
I have missed you too. So it's been a little hectic few weeks, but yep, all back.
Yeah. So you have some news.
About
your business?
Yeah, I do. And I guess kind of to preface this just a little bit, one of the things that I've been noticing lately is that question. That question about where should an author really enlist the help of an editor? Like, when do you actually know where that's at? And so I've kind of tooled out a little bit differently. And I'm starting to do more developmental editing with clients, but also coaching and alpha reads. Because sometimes, you know what, an author really just needs is to sit down with someone and talk about their story and try to figure out, are they at that point where it's time to start doing a developmental edit? Or is it time to do the content editing or the line editing? You know, like, what do you really need to have? And I'm really excited about being able to get in and working with people. And you can just go to my website, clark-chamberlain.com, or shoot me an email, clark@ripub.com, or you go direct to bookme.name/Clark Chamberlain and get all the information there.
Awesome. And we'll include all of that in the show notes. So if you just drop by there, you'll be able to find that if you can't remember all of that. And I realize I totally messed that up. We were going to talk about this. But because we have, you know, so many of our listeners are new authors, you know, they're working on their first or their second books and they don't necessarily know when is the first time that you should engage with, you know, start working with an editor and at different levels. And so, that was what we were supposed to lead in there with. I'm sorry.
That's okay. So, you know, because it really has come up a few times. Like I was working with an author and going through and doing a read through the book and trying to help her get some stuff fixed and finished and trying to help her come to a better understanding of what her story really was about. And unfortunately, like she had spent, not a small amount of money. I mean, editing is expensive. And she had someone edit the book, like do line editing, correct the grammar, you know, move a few words around here and there. But really, the story wasn't there. And it doesn't help you to do that part first. You know, like you need to know what you need in your book. And sometimes you don't know that when you're first starting out.
Yeah. And even like to me, even the people who understand, okay, I don't do line editing until the story is solid, that there are gradations, I guess, of, you know, the story being solid. And you, when the story, what am I trying to say? What I'm trying to say is that the author has to have a really clear idea of what the story is in their mind before they can really engage actively in a full developmental edit. Because to me, the point of the developmental edit is to kind of see what's in the author's mind and mm-hmm. what's on the page, and see how, you know, like, how do you fix that? Make sure that, you know, that one is the other. And that's just, I mean, that's only part of it. But if you boil it down, it's making sure the story that's on the page works. But part of that is, what is the story that the author really wants to tell? And so if you're struggling before that, then that's really a different kind of editing, like you said, an alpha read or book coaching, where you're kind of helping the author, because the editor at that stage, the editor doesn't want to push too much, wants to ask lots of questions, but not like, so the author can kind of find their way through the story, rather than the editor saying, well, if you're trying to tell this story, then this is what you need to do. And the editor's preference is kind of overriding what they are.
What the author is really trying to do.
Yeah. Because that's so important.
Mm-hmm. And one of the other things this stems from is that there is a natural fear among almost all authors to share their work when it's in that non-finished stage, because they're either worried about embarrassment or they're worried about someone stealing it. Mm-hmm. And so, like, working with someone, say, like me or you, Leslie, you know, where we use like non-disclosure agreements, so you know your work's protected while it's in my hands. I'm not going to go out and write a book based on your stuff. Right. You know, like, that's having that, because being able to actually say the words out loud, talk about the book, talk about the story, you'll discover so much more and like be able to brainstorm and really come up with what's going on with it.
Yeah. And having somebody, and I know critique groups work this way for some people, but for a lot of people, it really depends on who's showing up at the critique group and whether that will work for you and figuring that out. So it's very hit and miss. I know people who have fabulous experiences and then other people who had not great experiences.
Go home so, crying.
Yes. There's no need to go home crying. And you know, some investing in a developmental edit before you have that figured out is, you know, that's a lot, you know, that's a, because right. of all, what all is involved and how much time and care it takes with a full developmental edit. You have to, that's a lot if you don't already have a clear understanding of what your story is.
Exactly. So it's just important to understand, like, where you're really at, and that there are different, it's not just about changing grammar. It's not just about reorganizing story. Like, there's so many different things an editor can be used for, and you just need to, like, figure that out, which part you're at, so that you can come up with it. Oh, and I should mention one other thing, though. For developmental editing, I only have 2 more spots available for the year, because I only take one of those per month. Mm-hmm. And so I've only got August and November left. Okay. So.
All right.
So if you're into it, got to let me know soon.
If you want that, definitely. And again, we'll have the information for contacting Clark in the show notes. So if you're on the fence about it, and I know that, yeah, that sounds plenty to say, but reach out soon and build a relationship with an editor early on and talk to lots of them and don't wait till the last minute.
Exactly.
To do that. Yeah. Okay. So we have,
moving ahead,
yeah.
Do you want to do a quote?
Sure. Why not? Or, I mean, just, you know, for old time's sake.
For old time's sake? It's from Jeffrey Vandermeer. He says, but where should you start your story and when, given that it makes such a difference in the story's success or failure? For example, right now you're in a room with a talking penguin, a woman with a gun, and someone hiding behind a potted plant. From your perspective, you might want to rewind events to a point where you can make more sense of it all. However, many writing instructors suggest starting the story as late as possible. What does late mean? It often means that moment at which maximum dramatic tension occurs without the loss of so much context about character setting and other elements that the drama is meaningless or confusing.
Yeah. What does late mean? that's a fun stuff. So one of the things about writing advice to me is that it sounds so black and white. You know, well, this is what you should do. And of course, so much of it depends on the author, depends on the story, etc. But I think this is really solid advice. And it's because it does depend on the story. So it means, you know, and figuring out that moment is like, to me, okay, so it's like I first learned to drive a car, drive a standard. Mm-hmm. Which for some of our listeners, maybe they don't even know what that is. I don't know. I think of myself as being somewhat, yes. Anyway, blah. So when you're using a clutch and you need the clutch to engage, like there's a point that you feel for and you have to kind of practice and where the clutch engages, and that's when you can shift gears. And to me, that this is kind of like that. It's like there's a moment and you have to kind of feel for it. So it's not necessarily obvious and you can't necessarily, you know, it might not be an absolute black and white decision. Uh-huh. But there are certainly points that are more efficacious than others, like that make the, you know, that really start the story more powerfully than other points. And so kind of getting a feel for that, and don't be afraid to play around with the opening of your story and start, you know, like, what if I started here? And what if I started mm-hmm. here and experiment with that? How would that play out? Because that will help you get a feel for what you're going for, because it is kind of fuzzy.
Yeah, no, it absolutely can be. So, and knowing where that start point is going to make things a lot better. Did you want to talk about Harry Potter at this point, or should we do the story first and then come back to it?
Let's go ahead. Yeah, let's talk about Harry Potter, because I think that, yeah, we were trying to figure out how do we talk about this when we don't have a whole story in front of us. So I'm assuming most of you have read the first Harry Potter book. And if we look at that, you can see we have the prologue where we find out some backstory. And then we have because Harry's a baby in that part. And then we fast forward 11 years to, or just before, just about 11 years, to when, you know, shortly before Harry gets his letter to go to Hogwarts. And we get a taste of his ordinary world, like how life is for Harry before he gets the invitation, before he has the big revelation that, oh, I'm from a magical family. I don't, mm-hmm. you know, so it's important and really well done, I think, you know, she knocks it out of the park. I'm sure she'll be relieved to hear that from me. But anyway, but the point is what we were talking about earlier is if the story were to start when Harry got the letter, like then we wouldn't get the impact of what that meant to him in that mm-hmm. moment. It would be hard to really, really get it. And if we had, you know, from the prologue gone through Harry's entire life until he receives the letter, like if all of that were the early chapters of the book, then we would get lost because mm-hmm. it's not relevant to the story that's being told.
Yeah.
So having that understanding and looking at the looking at the stories that you love and where, you know, where do they start and that kind of thing can help you, you know, further find that sweet spot of where, mm-hmm. you know, where your story can begin most powerfully.
Yeah. One of the ways that I like to think about it is that we should see at least one of these three things at work, at home, at play, understanding who our protagonist, as far as the protagonist goes, the regular life before they enter into the larger plot. Now, if, you know, if you're like, I really want to have this big plot thing happening right at the beginning, you know, then maybe you should look at, you know, different types of points of view. Because let's take an example, different example, not Harry Potter. Let's jump over to Star Wars, the movie, the original one, 1977. We start in space with this big battle. We have the droids down on the ground. And then we are introduced to Luke Skywalker, who's our protagonist, having his normal, boring life being on the farm. And then we have his inciting incident and move him into that plot, into that bigger story that we showed just little bits and pieces of beforehand. And it would have been difficult to do that, like if it's a first person, if we just stayed with Luke the whole time.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's brilliant. I'm so glad you brought that up. Because, yeah, so it's going to be different for every story. And so looking at the stories in your genre or even outside your genre and, like, what's the effect that you're trying to accomplish and mm-hmm. what needs to be included so that the reader can, you know, like what Jeff Vandermeer says, that, you know, that there's we have enough context that we can make sense of it, but essentially no more than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So should we jump into this then?
Yeah, yeah. I know we don't usually do this much prelude, but it's good. We're kind of warming you up. So today's submission is called It's From the Flame. It's by Kristen Franklin. It's a fantasy. And when Kristen sent this, she was about 22,000 words in and she wasn't sure where she was going to stop. This is the beginning. We have the prologue and then we've got at least part of chapter one. So thanks so much, Kristen, for sending in your story. And Clark is going to read the submission for us today.
All right, here we go. Prologue, History of the World. In ancient days before the fires had started, water, wind, and wood ruled. Men were then only a thought in the Creator's mind. Only the fair folk lived in all the earth. The wind chatted and told the trees how it was to be so swift. And the trees, with their deep, earthy chuckles, shook their leaves at the stillness of its blustering. Water, who was always very busy, could be heard everywhere, whispering in pools, roaring over falls, booming on the shore, singing in the rivers. The Creator gave the elves the ability to speak to beasts, water, wind, and wood. There was much joy and harmony in the land, and there was peace for hundreds of years. Then men were introduced into the world. Unlike the elves, with their cool logic, men were subject to their emotion and easily led astray by greed and anger. They made fire and forgot where they came from. They started to cut down the living trees, ignoring their screams until they could no longer hear them. They dammed up the rivers, silencing the singing. Only the wind remained wholly unchanged, but witnessed it all, which set it more often to moaning and howling in those sad days. Men, jealous of the fair folk and their beautiful things, began to make war on the elves. They were not a warlike people, so many were killed. The few that were left fled their beautiful woods in the south and took refuge in the harsh lands of the mountains. Without the elves to protect and guide them, the southern woods became overgrown and angry. The animals fed from this emotion and grew larger and more monstrous until no man dared to go near except to cut down trees from the very edge. Some of these creatures, the winged lizard that men called dragons, grew angry, for they were the elves' friends, and they felt their despair keenly. As the anger and greed of the men grew, so did the anger of the dragons grow. As the fire of the men spread, so did the dragons take fire within themselves to spit back out on men. Men lashed back out at the dragons. One by one, they began to fall until both men and dragons were few. In their desolation, men could see their wrong and began to regret. But it was too late. The last dragon, whom the elves called Tinith, queen of the dragons, came to me. Deep in the mountains, I had gone, but she found me. She entrusted to me, Simon, her last two eggs, one green as an emerald edged with black scales, and the other red as a ruby scaled with gold. I was speechless as she told me that the last of her children had fallen, and she, with gray scales and an extinguished flame, was nearing the end of her days. She stayed with me until she faded away and left to meet the Creator at the beginning of all things. And so I became the guardian of the last two dragons on Earth. Exiled boy. Fire. It was everywhere. Every way he turned, there it was. His mother was carrying him, but she fell with a cry of pain. "Take him," she screamed. "I'll be right behind you." The man picked him up and carried him away down the river. That was the last time he ever saw his mother. As the boat carried them away, hot tears ran down his scorched cheeks. "It'll be all right, lad," said Corwin, his father's friend. As he looked back at the flames that had been his home, he didn't think he would be all right. How could he? Little Girl Chosen. Helena could hear the sound of hooves on cobblestone all the way down the lane. She wondered at the commotion and came out to the balcony. A glint of gold drew her eyes. Her nursemaid behind her whispered, "Creator, help us. It's her." She was hurried back inside and told to sit quietly on her bed until her father had summoned her, if he did. Father never summoned her when important people came to call, so she was surprised when a moment later the steward came up and bade her come. She looked over at her nursemaid for assurance, and though her eyes were shining with tears, the nurse forced a smile and nodded for her to go. As she came down the stairway, she could hear voices, mostly her father saying, "Oh, yes, we would be honored. Thank you, my lady." As she entered the room, she saw her father stand beside the hearth, so he faced his high-backed chair. "Come here, Helena Song," he beckoned. Timidly, she walked forward. Coming to stand by her father, she turned and found herself looking at the most beautiful woman she had ever seen. The woman was all in gold. Everything she wore reflected the firelight, but she also seemed to glow from within. The woman smiled, her cherry lips curving softly at the edges. She leaned forward and said in a voice as soft as velvet, "Hello, my darling. Would you like to learn how to become queen?" Chapter 1. Helena knew she should be getting ready, but she also knew that after today everything would change. So here she was, sitting on her horse, her hair a mess, whistling for her hound. One last ride with the choosing only 3 hours away. She didn't care. Rommel came bounding up, so off they went, into the wood, away from the stuffy books, the pinchy shoes, and the suffocating corsets. Away from the old men who talked for hours about the cost of sugar. Away from the cold stone rooms with musty rugs and tapestries. Since she came to the castle, she had done all she could to make her father proud by becoming the next queen. Helena longed for the moment when Prince Hagen would walk down the steps past the other girls, place the tiara on her head, kneel down and ask for her hand. Her heart thudded at the thought. She looked at the sun and spurred her horse onward. Her time had dwindled. She knew she was ready. Just this morning, the master of spies told her that he could teach her no more. He himself could not protect the prince better. Her head tutor had kissed her forehead and exclaimed that soon she could be teaching him. She would miss it all, surely, despite the cramp in her hand she developed after riding all day. She would never have told her tutor, for she loved him, but she preferred her combat training in the yard than sitting for hours in the tower. Helena looked down at her hound and yelled, "I'll race you!" She urged her mare into a gallop. Her hound bayed and ran even faster. She entered the clearing and pulled up on the reins. Right behind her came Rommel, his tongue lolling. He went straight to the clear pool in the middle of the clearing and lowered his head for a drink. She led her mare to the pool and dropped the reins. She could trust Ashka not to go far. A large monument stood in the center of the clearing. She walked over to it. It depicted a large-winged serpentine-like beast. She knew what it was. Similar effigies filled the castle. But in spite of her questions, only the servants would answer her. "That be dragon, miss," Jenny, her handmaid, would say. "Dragons, mighty creatures that lived in the days before fire, in the time of the fair folk." But they would never tell Helena more. They seemed afraid to. It all seemed the stuff of fairy tales, but she still loved coming here when she needed peace or a cool bath in solitude after the dust of the book rooms or the sweat of the training yard. The pool was fed from a stream that flowed out from between the claws of the dragon. Its origin was some subterranean river, but whoever had carved the figure had ingeniously made it seem like it came from the very heart of the dragon. On its shoulder, she would bathe her hot feet, thinking of the day. Sadly, she had no time for that today. She drank from the stream, closed her eyes, and asked, "Please, may he choose me? Help me to be the best queen to her people as I can be." She opened her eyes. She did not know where the prayer went, but hoped with all her heart it was heard. She mounted her horse, called her hound, and off they went back home. But she felt, as she had felt many times, that she was leaving home, not going back to it. She sighed and galloped on.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. So we have a really intriguing character and concept and a nice innovation that, you know, we have this young woman who wants to be queen, and she's not doing embroidery or playing an instrument. You know, she's learning to be a spy and she's doing warrior training, and so it's a nice twist on old conventions. So it's mm-hmm. kind of a fun setup for the story.
Yeah, and I like that idea as well. You know, being able to take the normal that we'd see and to turn it. It almost kind of reminds me of, is it Arya Stark?
Who, oh yeah.
You know, becomes the water dancer, you know, trains every day with her little blade out there. Yeah. So yeah, so something different than what normally should be done.
Right. Which, so that's a great setup for the, you know, for a story to have a character like that who's just, you know, who's different. So, you know, as you read, we have the prologue that includes three parts. And one is called the History of the World, one is Exiled Boy, and one is Little Girl Chosen, right? So, and then we have chapter one. And of course, when you're starting your novel and you're doing the rough draft, you don't, obviously, you're not going to be thinking about, you know, how do I make this opening as powerful as possible? You want to write, get the story down in that phase. And then when you're coming and looking at it afterward, then you want to, you know, start really looking at it, because you know how your rough draft ends anyway. And so mm-hmm. you're going to be kind of looking at those sorts of things, like you'll have the story before you, and you can look, as we were talking about earlier, about where is the most powerful place to start this story. And we don't have the whole story in front of us. And in fact, the author didn't have the whole story in front of her when she sent it. So we don't know how it's going to end. But just based on these parts that we have, I think that that of these, chapter one is actually the more powerful start. Mm-hmm. In part because, so if we, you know, look at the parts of the prologue, and we discussed, I wanted to mention this, we discussed in episode 96 that we talked about prologues and the reasons why you might choose to use them. And so that's something to consider. But setting that aside, looking at this, where we have history of a world, but we don't have a character to connect to. We mm-hmm. don't have, you know, and it's not long, but still I would say in most stories, you don't need to do this. That this it's so much stronger to reveal the world as you go mm-hmm. rather than saying, okay, these are all the things you need to know about the world.
Yeah. And, you know, we have this moment where she mentions only the servants will tell her about dragons. this is the type of place where you actually put in what we have here in our history, you know, that we have little conversations with someone, you know, one of the servants or whatever, who knows these types of histories. Of course, the narrator here, the Simon, you know, he might play a larger role down the line or something like that. Mm-hmm. But if just with what we have here, this would be easy to transition into some good dialogue scenes with these servants scattered about, not all in chapter one, but, you know, scattered about, so that the history of the world, the world building is done slowly and more powerfully.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I like to recommend, you know, that we, it's not like you do want to, okay. So, right. Tolkien did this essentially, you know, this same sort of thing with The Hobbit, certainly. And part of that is because he was sort of inventing a new genre, mm-hmm. you know, like, that this wasn't done. And so people needed a sort of primer before they were. But even so, today, I think a lot of editors, and I think they'd be right, would recommend don't dump all of this. Like, show us the hobbits and doing their thing and that, rather than giving us all of the, you know, the primer up front. And so if you pull the reader into the story with an enticing character in an interesting situation, then you have a much better, a much more powerful opportunity to pull the reader in immediately, because some readers are pulled in by, you know, fascinating worlds and that kind of thing. But what we really, I mean, a story is the character and what they do and how they react to the world. And so want to give them that as soon as possible. And it's not a rule of thumb. I mean, or it is a rule of thumb, I guess I would say. And more often than not, that's the case. And there may be exceptions, and people could say, well, but this book does it and they do it, uh-huh. you know, this is successful. And so I'm not talking about that. What I'm talking about is, like, how do you, as an, you know, new or early writer, author, pull in the reader who's never heard of you? And you do that by giving them a really compelling scene that hooks them with a character they can care about.
Right. And like you were saying, you know, Tolkien was inventing, you know, we have fantasies very established, you know, and we can expect certain things. Mm-hmm. If they were, I got to jump over to Twilight. If you're going to change the vampires to be sparkly, like, we need to understand that. But for the most part, you know, if there's a vampire, there's a dragon, there's a werewolf, there's whatever, we know what that is, right? And so we don't need to have huge introductions on things that we really have become which are really understood now, just because so many stories have been told in the genre.
Yeah, yeah. And to me, also, the mystery of there's a reference, I think, in chapter one that refers to the time before the fires. And if you, like, don't explain that, just kind of, you know, just drop that here. I'm just going to set this right here. You know, then, like, that creates mystery. That creates, you know, this, oh, what is that about? And, you know, helps add that, you know, that anticipation that pulls them mm-hmm. through. And again, this is an early draft. So the author hasn't gone back through and reviewed all this after, you know, reaching the end. And you wouldn't normally put this in front of the editor unless you're doing a book coaching situation where you're trying to figure the story out along the way. So mm-hmm. you wouldn't send this at this stage normally. But when you do look at your story, that these are, after the first draft, these are the kinds of things you want to be looking at. And then
really asking yourself whether or not is this information that I need as the author? Is this information that the reader needs right now?
Right.
Because a lot of times when we write, there's a lot of stuff that's for us, you know, as the author. We're just trying to put things down, and we're seeing the world, and so we're writing all about it. But at the end of the day, that stuff may become just for us, and that we rechange things around, like we're saying, you know, putting it in different places, adding more mystery to it, and making that, you know, like really directing what's important for the reader.
Yeah. And one other thing I would add about that is that by delaying and choosing where we reveal certain things about the world, like saving that till it can create, where its revelation creates that sort of, mm-hmm. like that moment for the reader where it's a surprise or it's a twist, or it like creates new meaning for the circumstances that are happening. Then, like, I mean, an extreme example of this, and you know, and one that happens at the end of the story is in The Sixth Sense, when we find mm-hmm. out that Bruce Willis's character is actually dead.
And, what?
Oh, sorry.
Oh my goodness! I haven't finished that yet.
Oh, that was funny. I'm sorry.
Sorry, I just need to be more.
I need to be better about these spoiler alerts for movies that are
more than 20 years old or something.
I know. Is it 20? Oh goodness.
I don't know if it's that long, but it's
close. If it's not, uh-huh. Yeah. So the point being that, like, that creates a. If we knew all along that Bruce Willis was a dead guy, then that would change. Like, that's not powerful. Mm-hmm. I mean, now, and I'm not going to say that's not a good story. I don't want to say that. That wouldn't be a good story because, you know, you could work with that. But it's a different story, I guess, is the point I'm trying to make. And right. So being mindful of the story that you want to tell and then using all of that information in a way that supports that particular story you're trying to tell in the way that you're trying to tell it. So then we have, right, we have that kind of world building, or history of the world. And then we have these little snippets. One is the exiled boy, and we just get a scene of him being, you know, he's separated from his mom, and one of his dad's friends, I think, is taking him and saving him from the fires, and that his mom dies there. And then Little Girl Chosen, we get a, you know, this Helena, who's our main character, will be, we get a glimpse of her and kind of it seems to be a thing that sets her on the path for where she ends up in chapter one. Mm-hmm. And so even these are not, to me, they're not fully, you know, they're not full scenes, and they're just little, you know, they're just snapshots essentially. And so again, you would want to look at, you know, is that necessary? Are those snapshots necessary context for the reader to understand what comes after, or can that information be revealed another time? Because I'm trying to think of how old. Do we know
how old she is?
Yeah, we don't know how
old time. We don't know.
Yeah, we don't know how old he is or how old she is. So we don't have, you know. So I guess what I was going to get at was, could the character remember that moment? Helena probably could. I mean, she's talking and such. But with the boy, we don't know. So again, that's all. And we're kind of groping around in the dark because we don't know how things turn out. But those are the kinds of things that you want to look at when you're trying to decide where to open it.
Right. And again, remember the Harry Potter stuff. Mm-hmm. We need to see some regular life regular life for Harry Potter was being under the stairs. Regular life for James Bond would be on a mission doing some spy stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, what's regular life for Helena at this point? Regular life could have been out there doing the working with the spy master, working with the tutor, you know, and then going off and doing something. So we want to see some things before we get to that point where life is going to change dramatically.
Yeah, because, right, she, well, we don't see it, but we know what's coming is that the prince is going to be choosing somebody. Mm-hmm. And there are all kinds of ways that could go.
Right.
Of course, you know, it could be that the ceremony gets put off because of something, or it could be that he chooses someone else, even though she has this expectation that it's not, you know, that he's going to choose her. And, or it could be that he chooses her, but then that's not, you know, that and just going the way we expect it to go wouldn't be as interesting given the setup.
And that's another thing I was going to say with our setup, where we've been saying that Helena is a different type of character. But honestly, we actually don't know that, because maybe this is like the island of Amazon women, and they all are training to be fighters and all of this type of stuff. So like, who's her competition to become the queen? Like, who else is around there? Do they all do the same thing? Do the rest of them sit around embroidering while she's out training with a spy master? You know, like, we need comparison and contrasting characters so we know what's actually going on.
Yeah. That would be really interesting. They're all kind of standing around looking tough.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, Helena, you think you're so bad. You're not. You're soft.
Exactly.
But anyway, I think, you know, it sounds like a really interesting world and a great concept for the queen to need these skills. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, it can be, you know, really powerful. And when the author kind of finishes that draft and then comes back to it, they'll have, you know, she'll have lots to look at and play with there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So anything else you want to mention about that?
You know, I think I hit pretty much everything that I had thought of on it. I don't suppose you have like an editorial mission or something similar to that.
I have precisely that, Clark. So this week's editorial mission is where to begin your story. So we're going to look at your story as a whole and where the protagonist is starting their journey and where she ends up. And what are the, you know, like, consider what events are, you know, where we're putting all of the players in motion. So you want to think about what happens before the story you've actually written and how, and, you know, again, it's fuzzy, but playing around with where can you put her that you reveal enough context? For example, the at home, at work, at play that Clark mentioned. You have enough context, but not more than the reader needs, and that you're withholding the information that you can use later for, you know, for more powerful revelation. And so, you know, looking at that, how to maximize the impact of the inciting incident, which is that, you know, the event that pulls the protagonist, it turns her world upside down and changes mm-hmm. everything. And so you want to, like, that's the moment you're leading up to. So how do you make that the most powerful it can be? And I think in this, the really looking at it as much as possible, you know, with no expectation or no, preconceived notion about where it should start. Just try to be as open as possible, as if you're looking at this story for the first time, and coming at it from that angle will help you find that precise moment that's the perfect place to start it. So that's your mission today. And remember that you can go to writership.com/episodes to sign up for editorial missions and have them delivered right to your inbox. I'm a little behind in getting the show notes up, but that will be happening more smoothly, and those emails will be going out again more regularly so we can get that to you. But you can always sign up for these at writership.com/episodes.
And remember, the Writership Podcast is brought to you by Jim Kukral and Author Marketing Club. Jim has just launched a new business for nonfiction authors called Business Around a Book. So if you're a nonfiction author, visit www.businessaroundabook.com and let Jim help you turn your nonfiction book into a profitable, life-changing business. That's businessaroundabook.com.
Jim Kukral and the Author Marketing Club cover hosting and technical support, but our Patreon crew supports our time in preparing for the show. You can support us there and earn some extra rewards by visiting patreon.com/writership. And a couple of reminders, you can still grab the 100 quick writing tips at writership.com/quick tips. If you enjoy the show, please leave us a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher. If you want your 5 pages of fiction reviewed, you can send them to us, or you can arrange to send them to us at writership.com/submissions. And be sure to check out the Book Editor Show and check out the show notes if you didn't catch Clark's contact info. If you are interested in working with him on coaching or developmental editing, then reach out to him for sure. That's it for episode 109. We'll see you next time on the Writership Podcast.
Ready for Leslie and Clark to help you find the treasure in your manuscript? Submit your pages to writership.org/podcast.